Good morning.
Everyone good? Good. So I'll be teaching. I'm teaching today, and the next week, Patrick Kilborn will be up. And then the week after that, Pam Windsor will be teaching. And then on the 30th is going to be a little bit different looking, in the sense of it has to do with our plan to protect. But there's a reason why we've put the plan to protect in for the 30th, and why we're doing that on a Sunday morning. And you'll have more understanding as we progress through this month. One of the things we're having to do is to, with Chris McQueen now on at Guelph, we are having to make a few changes, shifts here and there. As you saw this morning, we now have the Windsors in overseeing worship, but there's other areas that we're going to be putting people into as well. And we're being very intentional. We're looking at our setup here, how things can best work and how we can best move forward. You're going to see changes made as the weeks progress. Now, it won't be quick, won't be fast, because it's sort of like keeping a number of plates spinning. And we're making sure we don't have too many spinning, because we don't want any plates to drop and fall. This morning's teaching is going to be a little bit longer than what I would normally give, but I believe it is important for us to begin having discussions such as the ones we need to be having as a church family. The church in general needs to be having, and is being, I would say, almost put into a place where it needs to have these conversations. In my office, maybe you can see that, maybe you can't. It's okay. It's a flip chart paper. I brought it with me, but then I thought, what am I going to do, spin around and show everybody? That's not going to work. So I asked Lynn if she would be able to add that to the PowerPoint, and sure enough, she could. And that I have a number of little pieces of these flip charts up on my wall, and it's just a reminder of some of the key core areas we want to try and make sure we emphasize on a continuing, ongoing basis. What this one has to do with is the whole sense of sometimes, even this property, when we came on it, it can cause us, the staff, when I say us, the staff, to work in silos. Silos means you got, you know, Urban Hope over here, you got, you know, children's ministry over here, you got this over here, but there's not a collective, there's not an attitude of we're all working together for the same mission. And so this reminds me that we are, and I get to remind others, our staff, and that we are the vineyard, one community, one mission, many expressions. But one of the words that has been sticking with me for quite some time is this word authentic, and what that means, because I think there is some confusion, or not confusion, but different definitions that people apply to that, what authentic means, and the church being authentic. One of the realities is that I do see a bit of a disconnect between what I read in Scripture and what I observe when I look at the church in general. And what I mean by that is, if you'll notice in Scripture, one of the things you'll notice is that there are no spotless saints in Scripture. There are none. Not one of the people in there is spotless. They all have their issues. They all have their baggage. And the writers of those scriptures, for some reason, felt free to make sure that you were aware of that baggage that they have, which is interesting because, look, so here's the deal. Did you know everybody, I think everybody does, but everybody knows that they are broken. There might be the odd duck out there who is so full of themselves that they can't see it, that they're broken. But I think deep, deep, deep down, you know you're busted. You know you are. I know I am. And yet, as society, humanity, we have this propensity to build facades, you know? We have this thing to build facades. And a facade, you know what a facade is? Does everybody know what that is? Facade is basically, it could be just like a, you know, you have a square box for a building, but they put this nice front on it to make it look like it's a whole beautiful building. It's a fake front just to make it look good. Not that it isn't good, but it's not what it's being presented. That's a facade. Also known, the word that's known for that is hypocrite. Not how you present. And it's interesting, and look at, I look at my own life and I think about this whole thing of being authentic, and I am amazed at the amount of time and energy I put in to keeping this front before everybody. Because I have a front, I have a facade. I do. I know you go, what? Or maybe not. Maybe you're not. But we have this facade, and human beings do it. We do it, you know, with our finances, put a front on to make us look like maybe we're wealthier than we are or whatever, you know. We do it physically through and there's nothing wrong with this, cosmetics, plastic surgery. And you can tell when people go over the limit, right? Right? You know, they got that permanent grin on their face. That's a little creepy, a little bit. We put facades on when it comes to our emotional, you know, emotionally we do. The need for significance that we have, that we want to feel significant, and also and finally spiritually. And by the way, religious people are the best at putting facades up. They're awesome. And the church in North America and in the Western world, we have it down to a fine art. Fine art. We look pristine on Sundays. Well, we don't, but some places we used to. But even us, we look pretty good. We come in, we smile, how are you doing? Good. You know, and everybody's good. And we put so much time and energy into the building this facade. We make sure that we are presenting in a way that we think people want to see us as. We make sure we use language that people probably want to hear from us, because we wouldn't want people to hear our inner voice, because that would be terrible, right? And so we put all this energy into that. And for myself, if you could just peek around my facade, take a look at what's really there, you'd probably wouldn't be all that impressed. You'd probably go, ugh. Or you might go, well, that's what we expected. You know, if you think the church in North America is portraying an image of authenticity, I don't think it is. I don't think it is, and I think the world sees it. And it's not that the world's authentic. The world plays the same game. I think that's why they can smell it. They can smell inauthenticity, because they're in the same game as well, and they're looking for something different. And it's very difficult when they look at the church and they see the facade that's there. And I'm convinced the church in North America and the Western world getting shaken. Now, when I say that, that's not the first time it's been shaken, and it certainly won't be the last time. Every now and then God comes along when it's needed and shakes the church up. Shakes the church. It's like you sort of shake everything to get you back to the core, what it's really all about, right? And I really believe that the church is being shaken. Now, we have done a brilliant job in creating an airbrushed image. And you all know what airbrushing is, right? Be like taking a photograph of you, and then we airbrush out all those blemishes. Right? You know, you see some photographs, right? And this is some of the glossy magazines, you know? And it's like, what human being looks like that? Because photographs never do that to me, right? But some of these airbrushed images, and we become so adept at airbrushing We do. We really do. We become very adept at it. And almost we fool ourselves almost into the place that we believe that we have it all together, that life is all good. It's all, and it looks good on a Sunday, right? Or when we gather, it looks good. We keep it all together. And then we, you know, when we're away from each other, we can sort of let everything hang out, sort of like a girdle we put on. Although that's not a good picture either. But that is inauthenticity. That's inauthenticity, right? We're trying to have this image, and that's why it's contrary. It's sort of like, well, that's not what scripture looks like, because man, there's no airbrushing that goes on there. And or if it is, the writers didn't understand what that was all about. However, cracks are appearing in the church, and there's airbrushing that's going on that's trying to cover it up, and it ain't working because we can't airbrush quick enough, and the world's seeing, and it's out there, and they're going, we see the cracks. Wow. And the church has a choice. Either we can be honest with ourselves and be honest with society about what we are, or we can keep trying to airbrush the sucker. But the world's not going to buy it. That's the problem. Cracks. What type of cracks are we seeing? Sexual brokenness. It's totally out there. Oh my gosh. Let's start with the fiasco right now going on in the Catholic Church with child sexual abuse that has gone on. Now, the media will always, and I don't like to blame the media because the media serves a purpose, but the media will put a spotlight on certain areas, and that's all we see is that spotlight. We don't see what's outside of that. The truth of the matter is, because you can come away from that thinking all priests and bishops and cardinals are, you know, child predators, and that's not true. It's like 3-4%, right? That's even way too many, right? Like if one child has been abused, that's one too many. One too many. Not good. Not cool. Not at all, right? But you see it there. For those who are familiar with the church down in Illinois, Willow Creek, lead pastor and the founding pastor down there forced into early retirement. Why? Sexual misconduct allegations came out down through the decades with staff. They tried, Willow Creek tried desperately to airbrush. Didn't work. It's like the makeup fell off. Forced into retirement. Stepped down. This week, we have the funeral of Aretha Franklin. Right? Now, this is, you may not like hearing this stuff, but guys, this is what we got to talk about. Right? Aretha Franklin, there's a funeral. I never saw it. I heard it was like 9 hours long. So I feel pretty good when I can keep funerals down to 45 minutes. But 9 hours long. And then this accusation came out that there was one of the bishops, or one of the bishops on stage, it's live television broadcast on networks, live television. The word that's used is like there was a woman singer up on stage as well, and he was, you know, thanking her for that, giving her a squeeze, but groping going on. And I'm thinking, my first thought was, media attacking the church all the time, attacking pastors all the time. But of course, because it's live TV, there's video. You look at the video and you go, oh, really? Seriously? And you just shake your head. And hey, and there's cracks in the Canadian vineyard as well in this. If you've been tracking the news at all, if you've heard the news at all, lead pastor at the Winnipeg Center Vineyard, month ago, arrested down in California and charged with attempting to communicate with a minor for the purpose of sex. David Roos is having to walk that through, deal with that. Cracks all over the place. Then you have, these are things we don't talk about, we don't want to talk about. Then we have these things that we have to talk about as well, mental illness. It's slowly less of a stigma now, but it's still out there. Inland Hills Church in, I think it's pronounced Chino, California.
I think that's the name of the city. If I have that wrong, my apologies.
Chino, California. Mega church. Mega church. Pastor is Andrew Stockline. He took over from his father back in 2015. His father had died of leukemia. And the church is a mega pastor, a mega church. Like, it's huge. And just success, success, success. And back in April, the board of directors had to give him what you would call a forced sabbatical. Forced 4 month sabbatical because he was suffering with panic attacks and anxiety. And so he was off for those 4 months. And then he came back 4 weeks ago, came back. And on the video, him and his wife are up on stage, and they're just telling their story of what the past 4 months have been like. And you watch the video, and looks good. Smiles. He's just an extrovert guy. Smile, right? Wife, smile. But what they've gone through, they admit it's been tough. There's laughter. He's stressed, and she was saying, you know, that, you know, Andrew's committed to the call of God, and he loves his church and all that. That was August 12th, right? August 12th. August 24th, Andrew attempted suicide in the church. August 25th, Andrew died, 30 years old, married, left 3 boys. Okay, that's reality. But I was stunned when I heard the news. I was stunned not because a Christian had committed suicide. I was stunned because what pain was that dude walking through, right? What was he walking through? Because the other thing that puzzles me is, you know, the vast majority of pastors, probably 98%, only dream of having the success that Andrew had. Everything was going well. Offerings off the charts, you know, service growth off the charts. He had a mega church in the definition of the U.S. standards, which is huge, huge, unheard of in Canada. What pain was he going through? And what pain, how hard was it for him on August the 12th to stand up and say what he said? And he gave a great message, mess to miracle. And he told the story of Elijah, when Elijah had the showdown with the prophets of Baal. And he pointed out, because this was this passage that he really meditated on during his sabbatical. But Elijah had this mental and emotional breakdown right after this really significant spiritual moment. And he could identify with that. And it's funny because you're looking at, I'm looking for it, right? And you can see just little cracks the odd time of in the facade here with Andrew. And then, but if you weren't looking for it, he looked like everything has it all together. And it's things that need to get talked about. Things that need to get talked about. Anyway, so that was 2 weeks ago. The church is in turmoil, like broken, just broken. Brokenness, just brokenness. And his wife, Kayla, she wrote a post on his blog that he had. And she wrote it to him. And part of it, she says, and I quote, "Your story, your life, and your death is opening the floor for conversations all around the world. Your story is helping people to share their hidden thoughts and secret struggles with their family and friends. And your story is paving the way for an even bigger conversation about how the church can better come alongside people with mental illness, including pastors." You hear that sentence? Your story is helping people to share their hidden thoughts and secret struggles with their family and friends. And this begs the question, why are we so prone to erecting facades? Why? Why do we do that? Why? Why do we put up the false front? Which is a question I ask. I wonder, what is it? And the only way I can say what I'm going to say is I have to look at my own life and ask myself the question and search myself, why do I put up a facade? Why do I do that? Why? Why? Gotta ask why. And when I do that, what I come back with for me, this is me personal, I think I know best what's good for me. I choose how I will live my life. I will choose how I live my life. And in doing that, I'm able to remain in control. And so one of the ways of remaining in control is putting up a facade. That's one of the ways for me. For me. For me. And then I get confronted, of course, with Jesus, right? Jesus is always good at nicely getting in your face. Nicely. And Jesus was saying to people who wanted to follow him and his disciples, he had these words he wanted to say. This is found in Matthew chapter 16, verse 24 and 25. And Matthew records this in his gospel. Then Jesus said to his disciples, if any of you wants to be my follower, that's me. I want to be your follower, Jesus. Right? That's me. So I fit that. I'm there. Oh, you must give up your own way. Well, that's hard. That's harsh. Because I just finished saying here, I think I know best what way I need to go. I like to be in control. I like to choose how I'm going to live my life. And you're asking me, I must give up my way. You're not saying I need to think about giving up my way or consider it or let's try and negotiate. I must give up your own way. Take up your cross. That means die. Right? And follow me. And Jesus is saying to me, Scott, if you try to hang on to your life, you're gonna lose it. And I look at my words, I want control. And if I am intent on maintaining control, I'm going to lose it. But I'm afraid to give it up because I want, you know, it's that sort of, I feel like I'm backed into a corner here. Then he says, if you give up your life for my sake, you will save it. You will save your life. And this sounds so much like step one of the 12 steps, right? Everybody's familiar with the 12 steps. AA use it, NA, celebrating recovery. The 12 steps used in a number of areas, in a number of people suffering with addictions and stuff. 12 steps. Step one. Step one. You got to go through this, right? It says this. Now, this is with AA. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. All you need to do is change one word there, and you sort of have what Jesus is saying. Now, you could take out the word alcohol and put in, now some of us might put in sin, and I did that at first. Problem is, you know what I struggled with putting sin in there? Because how it would read is, we admitted we were powerless over sin and that our lives had become unmanageable. And this isn't right or wrong. I feel like in my head, I'm saying, well, sin's an outward force, therefore I'm not responsible. It's not my fault. Right? Now, that's just me. It might not be you. So you can put sin in there. What I put in there is this. We admitted we were powerless over our brokenness and that our lives had become unmanageable. That's what works for me. Now, you insert whatever you want. But two things. One, whatever you do, don't fall into the trap of saying, oh, no, I got my life under control. Because that's sort of almost proof that you don't. No, the reason we are all here, the reason we any followers of Jesus are in a church, you know why? Because their life has become unmanageable. And that isn't and what you can't do is make that a past tense thing. That was then. But my life's good now. No, it's not. Because if we take Jesus out of it, your life goes back. Jesus isn't a pill, right? That we take and we're all better. We need Jesus. We desperately need Jesus. When we sing, we need Jesus. If you read, pay attention to the Gospels, pay attention to the Psalms. It is. Without you, we are hooped. We desperately need you to come to us. We desperately need you to come to us. That is present tense, and we have to go back there all the time and say that over again. We admitted we were powerless over our brokenness and that our lives had become unmanageable. Essential step we have to take. I have to take. It's the way of the kingdom. That's what Jesus said. You must give up your own way. Shoot. And what we do, we skip step one. Or we did step one at the beginning, but then that's done. We don't have to acknowledge that anymore. That's done. And we think we can just move on. We can't. We want real life, and the way to real life is admitting we're powerless over our brokenness. That's the deal. See, it's bad news. It doesn't sound very inspiring, does it? But it's actually good news. Because when you get there, you get healed, right? It's when Jesus said to, remember, he was hanging out with Matthew and the other tax collectors and other scoundrels. The Pharisees, the religious, called them scum. And Jesus was questioned by them, or the disciples were questioned, why does Jesus hang out with such despicable people? Jesus overheard and goes, well, excuse me, I came for the sick, not for those. And if you read the words in the gospel, I didn't come for those who think they are healthy. He didn't say I didn't come for the healthy. He just said I didn't come for those who think they are healthy. And the reason the Pharisees couldn't get over, reason Jesus was a stumbling block to the Pharisees, is because as far as they were concerned, their life wasn't unmanageable. They had it all. They knew all 613 laws. They could say it forwards and backwards and sideways. They had it. And Jesus said, you're missing it. Step one, die to yourself. Die to yourself. Now, the reason it is so vitally important you don't skip step one, the reason, because when you skip it, it skews all the other steps, right? Skews it, the whole thing. Why? How? Because I hang on to the belief, and it's a good belief that I like to hang on to, but it's false, that I can manage my own life, and I can figure out my own way, and I'll get Jesus' help from time to time, right? That's what I do, right? Problem is, when I skip step one, I avoid acknowledging the core issue in my life. There's a core issue that we deal with, the brokenness, and I avoid that. Now, I intentionally avoid that because I don't want to go down that road. We don't want to go down that road because that's scary. I don't know what's going to happen if we go down that road. I might come undone. That's exactly what God, that's what exactly Jesus is inviting us to. Die to yourself. Give it up. Give it up. Right? Give it up. Right? But it's acknowledging. Like, guys, look, we go to the doctor. You go to the doctor, and if you know you got a pain in your gut, the doctor says, how are you doing? Fine. Okay, good. Well, on your way. Well, doctor didn't help me. Well, you got to tell the doctor. Tell him you're sick. I feel sick. But, you know, you only fake that for so long because then, you know, the doctor notices things and then they want to prod, right? Here, I'm just going to press. Feel. Ow. Oh, what's wrong? Nothing. I'm good. We're busted. But until I admit to God, until I acknowledge it, there's something about acknowledging it. Healing doesn't flow in. And we got to acknowledge. We got to talk about this stuff. Then healing flows in. And then we get to have experience that freedom we long for. And see, when I don't admit my powerlessness, when I'm depending on myself, you understand I deprive myself of experiencing God's acceptance and his forgiveness and his love for me. I deprive myself of that. Because you know what the good news is? God loves you just the way you are. No, don't run down that thing of, well, so I can just stay like I am. Well, who wants to stay like they are? Do you want to stay like you are with all your issues? Oh my gosh. I don't want to. If I could take a pill, an issue pill, anti-issue pill, it'd be great, right? Pop, better, right? If I could do that, that'd be great. But I can't. What happens, though? See, I need love. I need acceptance. I need it. Crave it. We crave it. We want to be loved. But when I don't, and where I need to get it from is from God. I need to experience it from him. And so what I do when I skip step one, I look for that unconditional love and acceptance from you. I want your unconditional love and acceptance. Problem is, you're in the same boat that I am. Because you're needing it and you're looking to me. And that creates a problem for us. We both have built facades. We both are playing this game. And healing will only come when we take that facade down. The problem is, I'm afraid to take my facade down. Because I'm not sure you will love me unconditionally. In fact, I'm pretty sure you're going to reject me, maybe. And you know what? And I really don't want you to take your facade down. Right? Because I don't want to see your stuff. You know why? I don't know if I could accept you. You know why? Because then when I look at your pain, I'm faced with my pain. And I don't want to see my pain. We play this stupid game, right? It's like unbelievable. What are we doing? But we want healing. Heal us, Lord. But we won't take down the facade. It's like, let's just, I think, you know, I wonder if God just, you know, stick in the spokes of the bike. Stop. You guys are going, and you're going to drive yourselves insane. But healing begins with the act of dismantling the facade that I have erected in my life. Healing begins when the church begins to dismantle this facade it has. What Kayla Stockline pleaded in her post was, the church has to talk about this stuff. She lost her husband. Now, I don't know what went on. I don't know why. I don't know. But clearly there's a plea there. I wish we could have talked about it. Wish we could have been real. Wish we could have. But we take down that facade and we stand naked before God just as we are. And when we do that, we'll experience his unconditional love and his acceptance of us. It's when David stood before God and said, God, I've sinned. I've screwed up. and God extended forgiveness to him. That's what you see there, David just said. Now, I think that's why how David is described as a man after God's own heart, because he was willing to not play any games with God. God, you know me. You know my heart. You know me. He writes in 139, right? You know when I go up to the mountain, down to the depths of the sea, you're there. You're always there. You know every hair on my head. Right? You know me. And when we stand just as we are before God, naked as we are, and we experience that, that's when, and we are known by God, and being known by God means we have acknowledged our brokenness. And that's when we know God. When Paul talks about knowing God, he's not talking about theologically, the systematic, you know, theologies and all that stuff and all the doctrines. No, what Paul's talking about, then we know God. We know his love and his grace and his mercy and compassion for us that never ends. It's like Psalm 115 says, verse 1, right? It's a beautiful. It says, not to us, O Lord. And the psalmist is talking about the glory of God. Not to us. It doesn't belong to us. All glory belongs to you because of your faithfulness and everlasting love. Everlasting. It's eternal. It's infinite. There is no end to it. Then we know God. Then we know we are known and we know God. And it's when I'm known by God that healing comes. It's when I take that first step, recognize my powerlessness, it's then I know God's love and his acceptance. And it's no longer about me. And I don't have to have this facade up. It's all about Jesus. And that's what it has to be about. The Bible isn't about spotless saints. It's about one person, and that person is Jesus. That's what the Bible's about. It's not about the people. It's about God. It's a story of God and his love for us. Church isn't about us. We don't have to dress up in suits and stuff. Now, one of the things, now all churches do this, but did you know at the beginning of the Vineyard days, they just wore jeans and t-shirts like the pastors did, right? Because older like me, I grew up in the days when it was all suits and ties and hats and gloves and all this stuff, and you had to look your best. Oh, you spilt milk on your, you can't go to church like that. Yes, you can. But that was important. There was a reason. There was a rationale behind it. One of the things in the vineyard that was there was, what you see is what you get. I'm the same person out there as I am in here. Nothing doesn't change. We don't want to clean up. Well, we are who we are, but we're all passionate about Jesus. That's what we are. It's what we do. It's what we sing for. Passionate about Jesus. The funny thing is, when I've encountered God's unconditional love for me, healing can begin. And then I can begin to move into that place of where I can extend unconditional love to you. Unconditional forgiveness. Because I know we're all in the same boat. We all say that we admitted we were powerless over our brokenness, over our sin, over whatever word you want to put in there, that our lives have become unmanageable. We can all, that's where it all begins. That's it right there. Right there. Paul says it beautifully in his, you know, the whole, his second letter to the Corinth church was all about Paul went through hell in his life. He had a period of just dark, tough times, persecutions. He was not accepted by the local church, by some of the churches he had planted. It was a rough go for him. But through it, Paul learned that, yes, he had weaknesses. And he got to a point where it was, he says these words. Each time he said, he talks about this thorn in the flesh. And Paul wanted to put a facade up about that thorn. He pleaded with God three times, he said. And maybe it was more, but three is that complete thing, right? He exhausted it with God. take the thorn away from me. And we don't know what the thorn is. He doesn't mention it because that's not the point of knowing what the thorn is. It doesn't matter. Who cares? He wanted the thorn gone. Take it away. Our answer is take it away because that's way easier. God told him, my grace is all you need, Scott. My grace is all you need, Paul. My grace is all you need. You can insert your name there. My grace is all you need. My power works best in weakness. Before I get there, and he says, so now I am glad to boast about my weaknesses so that the power of Christ can work through me. That's why I take pleasure in my weaknesses and in the insults and hardships and persecutions and troubles that I suffer for Christ. And then he says these words that we all know, for when I am weak, then I am strong. And Paul understood, finally, the first step, recognizing our brokenness and that our lives unmanageable. Because Paul knew then, that's when God's power shines. It shines. And healing comes and wholeness comes. That's when it happens. Look at guys. The world knows the challenges of life. We don't have to be pristine, spotless saints. In fact, I don't think the world's even looking for spotlessness. I think the world is looking for real. That the world can hear, oh, we're messed. You wonder why we have the same divorce rate as the world? Because we're messed just like you. But, we cling to a hope, and that hope is Jesus Christ, God's Son for us. That's our hope. That's what we cling to. That's why we come to worship. That's why we gather around. That's our center for our life. And we can come before God and we know we are loved and accepted. And we can say to society, we can say to the world, you come before God. You need to know you will be loved and accepted. You will be. You won't be disappointed. He is a lover of people. He is a lover of people.